Welcome to this podcast for Classical 91.5. I'm Julia Figueres. This season, Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra music director Ward Steer put together an American music festival. He's here today to talk about it. Welcome back to our studios, Ward.
Hi, Julia. Nice to be here.
Well, we have one down. That was on Sunday, and your American Music Festival is now up and running. So part one was Sunday afternoon. Part two is coming up this week. What was your inspiration for doing this festival?
Well, there were a lot of things that went into it, but I wanted to sort of highlight, remember, and celebrate the fact that Rochester has been a very important city for American music for almost 100 years now, really, because from day one, when George Eastman founded both the school and the orchestra, it became a stop, a destination for not only composers, but performers really all over the world. And, you know, this point was driven home for me. I remember when I first became music director and I looked back through the history of the RPO's performances, and there's actually a document that exists that I have that has the performance information for every single concert the RPO has given since 1922. It's fascinating. And it has the repertoire and the people involved. And some of the names that jumped off that page just astonished me, and it reinforced and confirmed what I already knew to be true, which is that Rochester is and was and always has been a very important city for classical music. So I thought, you know, we have that going for us historically. We have an orchestra that's fantastic, sounding amazing, and completely capable of doing this vast range of repertoire, which is very challenging for them, don't get me wrong. And I think the enthusiasm we felt in the community for the orchestra, the renewed sense of passion for classical music, which is wonderful. I thought it was all the perfect mix and a good time to do something like this and highlight all those things.
We should really, you know, spread flowers on Howard Hanson's memory, because he was really a big proponent of this American music idea. In fact, he had his own American Music Festival.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that we haven't done anything like this at the RPO per se, but it's not necessarily new to Rochester, although it's been, you know, several decades since Howard Hanson was here. But he was really a huge figure in classical music, probably most importantly because he encouraged the development of music here in Rochester, and he also was kind of the antithesis to the Boulez school of, you know, who cares about what people think, I'm just going to do whatever I want. And Howard Hanson was more along the lines of, no, this needs to have something that the audience can connect with, and it needs to have a melody. You need to be able to relate to it on some way. So he was very much in that of that school of thought. And he was right here in Rochester. So during his time, it was really an epicenter for activity and creativity in American music. And he, of course, himself was a great composer.
And let's not even talk about all of the composers who have come through this city, either to study or to teach
right
at the Eastman School of Music. The list is just monstrously huge.
Absolutely.
So having said that, how did you, Ward, cull that list of all of these things to pick out for just three concerts with the Rochester Philharmonic?
Well, it was difficult, and that's part of the reason why you'll notice on the season the American music theme is stretched out throughout the entire year, because when I was planning it, I was working with our artistic administrator, and we had all these great pieces that I wanted to program, and we just simply couldn't fit them all. So that's why you see more American music spread out throughout the entire season, which I'm very happy about. When we did the first couple Phil's weeks we've had so far, they've been very well received by our audience. And I think it really gives our audience and our community and our orchestra a chance to, you know, have an extended look at really the huge range of American music. I mean, that's one thing that stands out to me more than many other elements of it, which is that our American music is like our country. It's a melting pot. We draw from so many different influences. You know, there's Latin influences, the Cuban, Mexican influence. There's French influence. There's Native American influence. There's African American influence. And of course, there's a lot of traditional European influence, because when Americans, you know, first colonized this part of the world, they brought their culture with them, but then it started to sort of evolve a little bit in its own way, and it's fascinating. And we are, of course, you know, in our music as well as in our country, much younger than our friends across the ocean. So everything had to come together rather quickly, and I think it's interesting the kind of voice that emerged. And then you look at someone like Charles Ives, who is on this program this week, one of my favorite composers, really so far ahead of his time in terms of what he was doing with harmony and just in basic ensembles. I mean, he wrote multiple pieces which require multiple orchestras, sometimes multiple conductors, lots of different ideas going on at the same time. And that was all inspired by his experiences growing up in New England and hearing band festivals where you would hear different ensembles at different distances from you, but they all were registering with the ear. So it was almost like cacophony, but he made music out of it somehow. And it's brilliant. I mean, nothing like that had ever really been done in Europe that I know of. And you look at, much later, someone like Aaron Copland, who was able to capture the folk spirit, the frontier spirit, I think the purity and simple beauty that was very much a part of the people who came over, part of their mentality, you know, wanting to be free, but also being simple, good, honest people, you know, who then went west and conquered the frontier. And somehow Aaron Copland, who, you know, is from Brooklyn and studied in Paris, was able to capture that. And I think it's just amazing. So I'm happy that we have Copland on the season next week. And also we had him featured in our first concert this past weekend. So there's so much that goes into it. It was really a difficult decision because I love so much American music. But I think what we came up with is a good representation of, you know, all the cross sections, which are American music.
So you start off with John Williams,
right?
Who's about as American as they come, for a piece that he originally called "O Lenny, O Lenny," but we now know it as "For New York."
Right. It's I came across this piece a couple years ago, and it's just a really nice, very brief tribute to Leonard Bernstein. It was actually a gift. John Williams wrote for Leonard Bernstein on his 70th birthday. And it takes some themes from a couple of Lenny's pieces, New York, New York, you know, being from his show, you know, being the main thing. And he just plays with the themes a little bit, and it's very light, it's very bubbly, it's very celebratory. It's crafted in a way that you know it's John Williams, but he also uses Leonard Bernstein's sort of rhythmical flair and also the Latin influences that were so prevalent in a lot of Leonard Bernstein's music. So it's a nice way to kick off the concert, and I think it connects nicely to the Leonard Bernstein music, which is featured on the program as well, which comes from his only film score. So I sort of like that connection, a little inside joke. You know, John Williams, who's a master film composer, writing a piece for Leonard Bernstein, whose only film music we're featuring also on the concert.
Was there any place on record that you found to hear what Leonard Bernstein's response to For New York
no,
was?
No, you know, I should look for that harder, because I have not come across anything, and I would love to know what he thought of it. I'm sure he loved it.
I'm sure.
I mean, there's nothing more flattering than a composer writing a piece for you on any occasion, and especially a composer like John Williams writing for a composer like Leonard Bernstein. I mean, what a lovely gift.
Now, John Williams is very good at this movie thing.
He's got it down.
Leonard Bernstein really wasn't ready for what it meant to create movie music. This wasn't a comfortable experience for him, as it turned out.
No, he didn't like it at all. He found it extremely frustrating, and he, because he would just work so hard on these and craft this beautiful music, which he became very attached to, understandably. And then, you know, if Marlon Brando did something unexpected, you know, on screen, they might have to cut it, or they'd have to turn the score down. And Bernstein found that extremely frustrating by all accounts. But we're grateful that he made this suite so that the music itself can exist on its own. And it's wonderful stuff.
Why is it wonderful stuff? What is it about the music for On the Waterfront that is really so attractive to you?
Well, it's got that wonderful Bernstein sound. It's a mix of lyricism and driving rhythm, and there's a dissonance about the harmonies that he uses, which is very much like West Side Story. I mean, it's very compelling. But it's also got this tremendous sense of drive and direction throughout the entire piece. Even in the slower lyrical passages, they're always moving towards something, towards somewhere, towards some ultimate destination, which I like very much. It's a treat to conduct music like that, because you always have an end goal, and you can always really drive the phrase, you know, in a direction, which I enjoy. And it's a workout for the percussion, too. They have a lot to do.
Oh, it's Bernstein loved that percussion. Mm-hmm. Now, Bernstein spent much of his career trying to create the Great American Symphony. This seemed to be the thing that he really felt he had to do. Did he succeed in creating the Great American Symphony?
Well, he wrote three symphonies, and I'm not sure that any of them managed to eclipse Aaron Copland, who, of course, his third symphony is sort of known as the Great American Symphony. But, you know, Leonard Bernstein, he's a great sort of poster child for, I think, American music in general, because he himself is so diverse. I mean, if you look at all the works that he wrote, the many different genres, the many different sounds that he explored throughout his career as a composer, and to think that he was able to do as much as he did while still having this insanely busy career as a conductor, you know, his day job, which he, and a pianist, no, you know, and everything else that he was, an educator, lecturer, author. I mean, he was just an amazing man. So I'm not, you know, with no disrespect whatsoever to Leonard Bernstein, I'm not sure he really achieved that, but I think maybe what he did give us and his legacy is just as rich and just as important because of the wide variety and the powerful music and emotions that he left us with that we still feel so strongly today.
Sandwiched between the two Bernsteins is is another great American composer, mm-hmm. George Gershwin, who's making two appearances in your festival.
Right.
He was last Sunday with Lullaby.
Right.
Such a beautiful piece. This time around, a fairly quick but awfully snappy little work.
Oh, yeah.
The I Got Rhythm Variations.
Well, I thought it was... I wanted to include this piece in particular because, you know, it's a familiar work for the audience. I thought Gershwin belonged in the mix somewhere, and also the fact that rhythm is such a... it's kind of an inside joke, I guess, in a way, because rhythm is such an important element in all these concerts, actually, over all 3 weeks. And I Got Rhythm, I thought, was just a nice little nod to that. And it gives us an opportunity to feature a soloist, and Andrew Russo is going to be with us, which is great. And it's not a very long piece, but it'll be one that I think is very enjoyable for the audience and sort of, you know, complete the first half, which is a little bit lighter, I guess, especially compared to the second half, which deals with some very heavy subject matter, and it's very intense for the audience and the orchestra.
And you talked about all the legacy of Bernstein, but what is the legacy of Gershwin? When we talk about Gershwin, what was his importance?
Well, Gershwin is another one who... His work was sadly incomplete, and you know, not because he was too scattered in different directions, just because he died at such a young age and so suddenly and so tragically. But Gershwin was able to, I think, take... Well, of course, he started in Tin Pan Alley, you know, and writing jingles and things like that, and then you get Swanee and his early hits, which were very much, you know, in the style which was popular then, but it sounds very dated today. But then the way Gershwin was able to evolve and develop, I think, is tremendously fascinating. And he had going for him at the same time the gift, what I call the gift of melody. It's like, you know, Tchaikovsky had it, Mozart had it, certain composers. Beethoven did not have it, by the way. Beethoven's brilliance and gift was in his ability to develop and his ability to create amazing architecture and his ability to create music which just hit directly on an open nerve and was so instantly compelling and communicative. But Beethoven didn't write the best melodies out there, not by any means. Mozart, yes. Tchaikovsky, yes. Gershwin, yes. Gershwin had that gift. But he was also smart enough and talented enough to be able to take that gift for melody and modernize it and give it a real American sound. So he was able to take his experience with early jazz and the music of Tin Pan Alley and sort of evolve as, you know, the big band era came and swing came in. And he managed to stay out of those arenas, though. So his music is not, it doesn't sound like dance band music, but you can hear the influence, you know, and it doesn't sound like, Scott Joplin, but you hear the influence. It doesn't sound like Aaron Copland, but you hear the influence. It doesn't sound like Ravel, but you hear the influence, and that's brilliant. You know, one of my favorite stories about Gershwin is that he, when he went to Europe and he sought out some of the best teachers, Copland's teacher, Nathalie Boulanger, for example, Maurice Ravel himself, he went to Paris and tried to study with these people because he was such an intellectually curious person. He was so driven to develop his own talent that he wanted guidance from the best people. And both of them reacted in the same way and said, no way. If you study with me, I'll ruin you. And he said, why? And Ravel said to him, why would you want to become a second-rate Ravel when you're already a first-rate Gershwin? And I think that's just wonderful. And so if you look at all that, then, you know, the experiment with the Rhapsody in Blue, what he did with American in Paris, and then going even further, what he did in opera in Porgy and Bess, which is a piece I absolutely adore. I conducted it 15 times in Chicago a couple years ago, and it's a piece that's just epic. It's monumental, and it is so powerful, and Gershwin, his style was evolving, and it breaks my heart when I think that he left us when he did, because he was getting ready to write another opera, and he probably would have eventually written a great symphony. Maybe Gershwin could have written the Great American Symphony. Who knows? We never will, but all the music that he did leave us with is just astounding, in its diversity, but also in its beauty.
You've conducted Gershwin a lot, and you mm-hmm. obviously are, he's very important to you. Is there a performance technique that you need with him? Gershwin kind of walks this fine line with pop and jazz and classical all intertwined. So as a conductor, do you have to approach Gershwin differently than you would something else?
Sometimes there are places in some of Gershwin's music and some of his best-known pieces like American in Paris where it's dangerous, because if you get a little bit too casual about it, thinking, oh, this is swing or this is, you know, a more easygoing music, it's not. It has to be executed very precisely, and there has to be a lot of attention to detail. And you also can't fall into the trap of going too far in one direction, like, you know, swing, for example, which after Gershwin died developed into, you know, the really heavy, heavily swung, really deep kind of groove. That's not Gershwin. Gershwin is not that. And too many people, I think, go too far down that road. Yes, there's an influence. Yes, it's part of it, but it's not all of it, because, you know, he also loved Bach, you know, and he also loved very kind of square, precise music. And he was very exacting in what he wanted, by the way. I mean, all the accounts of him in rehearsals and the compositional process, I mean, he was no slouch in any way, shape, or form. So I think you have to approach it with the same vigilance and the same attention to detail that you would, you know, something by Brahms or Shostakovich or, you know, any other great composer. So to approach it too casually is a mistake, and I think also to be too indulgent with it is also not really right, because if you go back, and fortunately we do have some recordings of Gershwin playing his own music, I'm always amazed at, number one, how quick some of the tempos are, which surprises a lot of people, and also how you know, how precise it really is. It's a little bit more like Joplin, Tin Pan Alley, you know, 20s kind of sound, late teens kind of sound, than it is 30s, which is when he was writing a lot of the music. But there's a great recording of American in Paris, which was one of the first recordings, I think, that was made of it, and Gershwin supposedly is playing on it. So he was there in the studio when they were making the recording, and there was recently an article I saw about it, because the famous taxi horns are not pitched like we usually think they are today, and someone put two and two together and said, wait a minute, George Gershwin was in the studio when they made this recording, and if he didn't stop and tell them it was wrong, then that must be okay. So then it made everyone look at the taxi horns in American in Paris in a whole different light, and if you also listen to that recording for some of the tempi and for the trumpet solo at the end, it's not, that's a great example, because it's not do-di, 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 do-do, da-da-da, it's not that at all, it's da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's much more taut. It's much more crisp. And so, you know, you have to keep that in mind when you conduct Gershwin.
And now all the orchestras will have to buy a new taxi horn.
Right.
After the Gershwin, also on the first program is the nebulous, in the first half of the program, the nebulous unanswered question by the gentleman you've already talked about, our favorite insurance agent, Charles Ives. And what is the question that is unanswered?
Well, I think it's kind of an existential question. It's kind of a vague. I mean, there is no specific question, and there is, as the title suggests, ultimately no answer. But I've always liked this piece, and I liked pairing it with the Atoms because the subject matter of Dr. Atomic is, of course, very much along these lines, where Oppenheimer, who was the head of the Manhattan Project, you know, trying to split the atom for the first time and weaponize it and do all this just really earth-changing, life-changing work during World War II, he himself went through a tremendous crisis of conscience, and he was asking himself a lot of questions, which I think ultimately remained unanswered. And that's all in the opera. So starting with Charles Ives' unanswered question just puts us in the frame of mind, I think, to consider all the turmoil and all the pain and suffering that went into Oppenheimer's experience with the Manhattan Project and the atomic bomb.
When we talk about earth-breaking or, you know, earth-shattering, groundbreaking works, I always come back to the unanswered question because it is a tone poem. And it's a tone poem long before tone poems were really being written. It's way ahead of its time.
Right. Well, and it's fascinating the way it's set up. There's not a need really for two conductors, although it can be done with two conductors. But sometimes you just let the woodwind ensemble sort of conduct themselves. The first flute will lead it. And you can do a lot of interesting things with the placement of the different ensembles because it's basically three groups. There are the strings who begin, and it's very peaceful, calm music. Ives writes that it's meant to represent the ancient druids who, I don't know, he says they know nothing, they see nothing. It's kind of this very sort of neutral character in this dialogue, but very beautiful and sort of pensive, I guess, without influencing either the question or the answer one way or the other. Pensive but neutral, I guess, would be an okay way to describe it. And that's very much, you know, very tonal. And then you get this first statement of the question, which is played by the solo trumpet. And this line is very nebulous, and it has no tonal center whatsoever. And again, you think of the time. I mean, Ives was writing this over 100 years ago. He's so far ahead of himself, you know, thinking about these things. And so the unanswered question, well, of course, it would have no tonal center. It's brilliant. And the way it floats atop the string chorale is just, it's mesmerizing. It's so beautiful. And then you get the first attempt to answer the question, which is made by the woodwinds, a small group of woodwinds, which again, Charles Ives gives you a lot of options. You can do it with four flutes. You can do it with two flutes, an oboe, clarinet. There are many different ways to do it. We're going to do it with two flutes and an oboe and a clarinet. And so the answer comes in, and at first the answer is rather simple, just like the question and the chorale at first, and then you hear the question posed again. And by the way, the three elements are working together, but the string backdrop remains constant, so the strings never stop playing. So you have this neutral but pensive background to all this and this dialogue between the trumpet and the woodwinds. And so the trumpet repeatedly asks the question, and every time the woodwinds answer, the answer gets a little bit more intense. It's almost like whoever is trying to answer this question is getting frustrated because you can't find the correct answer to the question. And in fact, Ives writes in the notes that come with the score that the answer, he calls it the fighting answer. So it's the struggle to try to answer this question. And so each time the question is posed by the trumpet, the woodwinds get more and more, they get faster, they get louder, more intricate, until finally it's like they just give up. They give up in trying to answer this question. And then you're left with this beautiful string backdrop, and then the question is asked one final time by the trumpet, and then the strings just sort of evaporate into thin air, and it really leaves you in a very sort of reflective, pensive place, but you don't get an answer to the question. So the title is really perfect. And so after that experience, I feel like it's a perfect opportunity to jump into Dr. Atomic. So we're actually going to go Ataka with no pause, no applause, nothing, straight into Dr. Atomic, which is a complete contrast. It opens in the laboratory with just this, literally it's like an explosion of sound in the orchestra. The timpani is very dominant. There are huge, massive chords being passed around the orchestra, and lots of swells and intense crescendi, and you get a real feel of gravitas and the weight of the world, which was on Oppenheimer during this time in wartime. It's just tremendously compelling. And the first scene is rather brief, and then the second scene is the big one. And he writes, John Adams writes at the top of this section of the music, "Panic." which is interesting because, again, you have to remember the historical context of this. And when they had not yet, you know, successfully tested the weapon, there were some who believed that a detonation of an atomic bomb would ignite the atmosphere of the Earth, and so literally the world would come to an end. I mean, there were serious questions about this and legitimate fears. And so this is what the scientists and all the people working on the project were grappling with, and all the pressure was on Oppenheimer. So the poor man was dealing with this crisis of conscience, as I said, where he was wondering if he should, you know, and then also wondering what's going to happen if I do. So those are big questions which were floating around at the time, and they're dealt with during this opera.
This comes out of the John Adams opera. Does it follow the opera faithfully from beginning to end? Is it a synopsis of the opera?
I wouldn't call it a synopsis, no, but it's a snapshot of the most important elements of it and the key emotional links and also, you know, sonic links in the opera. One thing that comes in the end, the last movement is called Trinity, is the beautiful aria for Oppenheimer, where he quotes John Donne and he quotes "Batter My Heart," and it's again his own inner conflict that's happening throughout the opera, and he's questioning a lot of things, and it's played by the trumpet in the suite in the symphony.
Trumpet's very busy.
Is very busy in this concert, right? And so you'll hear Oppenheimer's aria and a lot of other great music from there. There's a scene in the laboratory where there's a lot of chaos in the strings. You'll hear, you know, crazy colegno where they're hitting the bow with the wood on their string, making a lot of racket, and it sounds very chaotic, and it's meant to, because, you know, it's everyone running around the laboratory in the field trying to prepare for this first test, which everyone is tremendously anxious about. And then the first trombone stands up on stage and plays this really gruff kind of barking solo, which is meant to be an army general screaming orders at everyone over the chaos. So you really get a vivid picture for the action that's going on in the opera and what was happening at the time.
I assume you have seen the opera.
I have seen it. I saw it in Chicago.
So what kind of impact did the opera have on you when you saw it?
I remember being very moved by it. I mean, I'm also a history buff, so I love that whole period around World War II. I mean, it's fascinating. And I thought that the opera did a great job of capturing a lot of that energy and those emotions that these people were experiencing. And it also was more personal when it comes to Oppenheimer and in his inner struggle, which you don't hear as much about.
So when you got the symphony and you looked at the symphony that was inspired by the opera, mm-hmm. I think is a better way of saying, because it's not really the opera. Did you think that it had translated well between what you had seen as an opera and what we are going to hear as a symphony?
I think in a way, if I can have the forgiveness of all my diehard opera friends, I think it might even be better than the opera, because it just for the music, because it's a real... it boils it down to all the most intense moments, so you don't... There's no time wasted. There's not a wasted bar in the entire piece, and I love that. It's somewhat similar to Strauss's Rosenkavalier Suite, which, you know, I love Rosenkavalier, don't get me wrong, and when you get to the trio, it's like nothing else in the world. But, you know, I've played Rosenkavalier, I've seen Rosenkavalier. There are moments in Rosenkavalier where you think, okay, let's move on. And I'm not necessarily saying that's true in the Adams opera, but the thing I like about the suite is that it's got all the greatest moments strung together very beautifully and very well, and it gives you a very satisfying experience at the end, and you don't have to spend 4 hours doing it.
And there is actually a parallel here, between the Dr. Atomic Symphony and the On the Waterfront music, because in both cases, both composers were able to take this music and actually present it in a new way, and perhaps in a way that they might have preferred,
mm-hmm.
or they might have maybe felt would relight the music in a new way.
Well, it puts the focus squarely on the music and nothing else, so you can just concentrate on that and not worry about, you know, the screen in the case of the film, or the action on stage in the opera in the case of the Dr. Atomic. So I think it's great, and you know, I've known this piece for many years because I was resident conductor of the St. Louis Symphony I started just after John Adams wrote the piece for David Robertson, actually, and the St. Louis Symphony recorded it. And I was part of that process when they made that record, and I was the resident conductor when they toured it all over the world, the Dr. Atomic Symphony. So I've found it just so exciting and compelling from day one, and it's been on my list for a long time to conduct myself. I was ready to conduct it back in 2008 because I was covering, but I never got the opportunity. So I'm thrilled to do it in Rochester this week, and I think the audiences are really going to enjoy it. It's such a tremendously powerful piece.
I hope you'll be giving context before this starts, because that's the hard thing.
Right.
When you're listening to something like this, there is no context. It is what it is. You know the opera. You love the opera. You can walk in and say, oh, this is where the general is barking. Mm-hmm. This is where Oppenheimer is really worried about his choices. But we who have never seen Dr. Atomic might not be in on that.
Right. No, it's important to frame it for the audience, I think, and there's a very good chance I'll be doing a little bit of talking from the stage just to help people experience it, because as you said, when you know what's going on and what's being dealt with in terms of the drama and the subject matter, I think it makes a difference in how you listen to the piece.
When we talk about playing Gershwin, and you talk about playing some of this slightly older American music as opposed to John Adams, mm-hmm. is there a danger of seeing this music through the filter of 21st century eyes and losing what maybe that piece was all about in the first place?
You mean looking at older pieces like...
Yeah.
Well, I mean, maybe context is always important in the sense that... and even with, you know, European classics, I always look at the context in which it was written to try to be more informed about how I form my own interpretation. But I think any great artist, any great, you know, conductor, soloist, orchestra musician, composer will tell you that, you know, once it's on paper, it's got a life of its own and a piece will evolve. And I think George Gershwin would have actually been a very strong advocate for pieces evolving had he lived longer. So I think it's important to respect and have and be mindful of the context, but also, you know, to look at it fresh.
When you talked about the unanswered question, that is a piece that is, as you pointed out, over 100 years old, and yet it has this fresh sound mm-hmm. to it. How does that happen? Why does something manage to survive and still sound new?
Well, I think in the case of the Ives, it's even still, if it was written yesterday, you would think, wow, that's really innovative, you know, and to realize that it was written not yesterday, but 100 years ago plus, I mean, that's even more fascinating. But I think when someone has a truly original idea and a unique voice, it's timeless. I mean, Mozart still sounds fresh. Tchaikovsky still sounds fresh when you hear it for the first time. I'm getting ready to do some of the scenes from two of the great ballets, Swan Lake and Sleeping Beauty, in another city in a couple months or a month now. And I haven't spent time with that music in a long time, and it's just astounded me how it's so familiar, but it still feels fresh because it's brilliant. And, you know, when you have a work of art that's so original and so artfully crafted and just... so beautiful, it really transcends time.
So do you think 100 years from now, Dr. Atomic Symphony will still sound fresh?
I think so. I think there are moments in it. You know, Adams, it's interesting if you look at Adams himself and how his own style has evolved. I think he's actually gotten more romantic as time has gone on. And there's a lot of, his music is more lush now and more full-bodied, in my opinion. But he also does some things. For example, he writes passages where the strings, the violins in particular, have trills, which are basically, they're almost like tone clusters. They're very dense, but some trills are whole steps and some trills are half steps. And that may seem unnecessarily complicated, but it actually gives a very unique color and atmosphere. And then he'll pair that with bowed cymbals, which sound almost like, you know, feedback from a microphone. But the combinations of sounds that Adams has found in this piece are really amazing. And then there's one passage where the strings are playing all sorts of amazing combinations of colors and techniques like what I just mentioned. And then over the top, you have a beautiful romantic horn solo. And the juxtaposition is really striking because you have a beautiful melody in the horn, which is very soothing. And, you know, if you had it by yourself, you'd think, oh, that's very nice, you know. But underneath, you have this tremendous unrest, and the string texture is so unsettling and eerie. But that was the energy that was going on at the time when they were about to test this bomb. And it's just, I think it's brilliant. So I think, yeah, in 100 years, if someone's conducting this piece and they're looking at the score, who knows where we will have evolved to at that point. But I think it'll still look very original and be unique.
And this is the Rochester premiere of the Dr. Potomac Symphony?
Yes, it is.
Well, congratulations on getting that done as well.
Well, thank you.
Well, you'll be back, I know, next week to discuss the wrap-up of the American Music Festival. So we will revisit this in about 7 days.
All right.
Thank you very much for coming in and chatting with us today, Ward.
My pleasure.
Our guest is Ward Stair, and if you would like information about the Rochester Philharmonic season and this wonderful American Music Festival, you can go to rpo.org. I'm Julia Figueres. This podcast is a production of WXXI Public Broadcasting.